today, United States against Javel. Ms. Gaisberg.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Lauren Gaisberg. I'm one of the attorneys for the appellant defendant, Louis Javel. Mr. Javel had a jury trial on allegations of mortgage-based wire fraud arising out of an approximately $150,000 loan, of which about $5,000 was the commission that his company, Bell Capital, received. Tried on the same indictment before the same jury was his co-defendant, Aisha Arroyo, who was an employee of Mr. Javel's. Neither of the defendants testified. However, Ms. Arroyo's post-arrest statement was introduced at trial. That statement was redacted. Both defendants were convicted on all counts, and our appeal challenges both of Javel's convictions, and we ask for a new trial. There are a couple of critical things that I'd like to point the Court's attention to. One is the relationship between Mr. Javel and Ms. Arroyo, which is critical for the determination of the Bruton issue, which we present as a quite unique Bruton challenge.
But let me say on the Bruton issue, you know, you've put in the redacted statement, pages 10 through 12 of your brief, and it looks to me like we're really under Richardson against Marsh here. I don't see anything in this statement that implicates Mr. Javel. Now, true, other evidence that comes in at the trial shows that there's a relationship between him and Arroyo and so on, but Richardson is about redacted versions of the statements, and you could look at this statement and think that she was off on a excursion of her own, even. You don't have to. It's just not like Bruton. It's not something that points only to him or exclusively to him.
Right. I completely understand Your Honor's position on that. Richardson v. Marsh did narrow the Bruton finding, and it does allow for redactions of a statement. The standard under Richardson is if the redactions eliminate the defendant's name as well as any reference to his existence and a proper limiting instruction is given, then a redacted statement does not violate Bruton. Turning to the statement itself, our position is that you can do all the redacting you want, and you can take out Mr. Javel's name, you can take out the name of Bell Capital, but references in the statement where, for example, it says Arroyo acknowledged that these recordings, which they're referencing some wire or video recordings, surveillance, of her at her place of employment.
But why is I don't see at the level of specificity that Richardson seems to be talking about, Mr. Javel lurking in there. He might or might not have even known that she was being recorded there.
Well, I think the issue is that when Arroyo tells the FBI, and then the jury is told that this happened, and that Arroyo tells the FBI that these things took place at her place of employment, that Scaff, who's sort of the...
I think we need to be more concrete. Let's assume the statement had named the place of employment so that everybody on the jury knows is being hit in the face with the proposition that Arroyo worked in the same place as Javel. What your brief says you're worried about is that the jurors would infer, apparently, that Arroyo's knowledge and bad intent would be imputed to Javel. Right? There's nothing in the statement that says that Javel did anything wrong or that Arroyo told Javel anything. So you're worried about an inference imputing the knowledge. Did you ask the judge for an instruction telling the jury that the only question in this case was what Javel knew and what Arroyo knew is irrelevant?
I don't think that those specific words were requested for an instruction. And pre-trial,
isn't that the concern? Right, if you're concerned about the spillover effect of Arroyo's confession, the best thing for the judiciary to do is address that possibility directly. Now, I might understand why a defendant would not want that instruction. Because maybe they're worried, maybe a defendant would worry, that reminding the jury about the possibility would get the jury thinking along those lines if it wasn't already thinking along those lines. But it's not because there was anything particularly bad in the statement. It's because the jury may or may not have known about the rule for non-imputation.
Well, and a request for the limiting instruction, which I believe is...
The last paragraph of Section 3.02 is completely meaningless garbage. Right? It's perfectly understandable why the district court omitted it. It's important. Instructions are too long as it is, and platitudes don't help. Right? There might have been a use for a precise instruction, like Arroyo has confessed, but what she did and what she thought and what she knew can't be imputed to Javel. That might help.
I agree that that may help, and I think that, you know, our position is that at the very least, the last part of Instruction 302 should
last
have
part
been
of Instruction
given.
3.02 is empty platitudes. I don't know why you're arguing in favor of the platitudes, but don't seem to be interested in a precise instruction that would match the facts of this case. One thing we keep saying is that district judges need to make the instructions concrete by relating them to what's actually going on in the litigation before them, rather than giving statements of law that don't mean anything to juries. And that's the puzzle for me. You seem to have wanted the platitude and not the concrete instruction.
I think the issue here is that with the record that we have in the trial that we had, the jury was only given, I mean, talk about platitudes, just very general statements, instructions about what that, you know, that the jury could consider evidence against one defendant and only that defendant. However, they were never told specifically what evidence applied to each particular defendant.
Exactly my point, right? You don't give the general platitude. You tell the jury concretely, here's a bit of evidence. If you think it bears on Javel, no, it doesn't. Right?
But that is your complaint, isn't it, in part? That however it was done, that wasn't accomplished in the instructions. The district court just gives one fairly vague instruction about the last sentence applies only to Arroyo, but doesn't ever say, and as a matter of fact, all of it applies only to Arroyo.
That's correct. And our position is that the failure to give an instruction that was specific and specifically told the jury that, you know, that the statements introduced into evidence that were made by Ms. Arroyo only applied to her and should only be held against her, that was error by the court. And
but
so,
the problem
however,
is, aren't you under plain error for that? Was there wasn't a particular enough request, again, no matter how we write it down.
Right. There was an initial request pre-trial. However, there was no request made later. So I think that, again, no matter how we got to this point, plain error does apply. And I would also acknowledge that there is a higher hurdle for plain error in a jury instruction issue. However, here there's four, and I'll go through them quickly. There's four reasons why plain error applies here. One is that in this specific Bruton context, the case law is absolutely specific. I didn't find one case, and I don't believe the government cited a case where a Bruton challenge was evaluated and there was no limiting instruction. In this case, there was no limiting instruction. Number two, the presumption that arises out of Bruton and then follows in the remaining cases is that a jury cannot be trusted, so to speak, to follow a general instruction in light of a co-defendant's admission because it's such strong persuasive evidence. The third is that the trial court pre-trial specifically found that an instruction, a limiting instruction of this nature, was necessary, and the trial court noted the significant Bruton issue in this case. And finally, the government does reference in their brief a very sort of narrow instruction that the trial judge did give during the introduction of Arroyo's statement, and he told the jury after the statement came in that she had engaged in seasoning of accounts with a dude at the bank. The judge told the jury that last statement by Arroyo should only apply to Arroyo. Well, that sort of created open season for the rest of the statement and all of the other bad acts that came in and everything else that was introduced. And so that makes the problem worse here. There was a miscarriage of justice, and under Macari, under Clark, I feel like we meet the plain error standard. And I know I've got I think 1 minute left, so I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Hotali.
May it please the Court, my name is Chris Hotaling, and I represent the United States in this appeal. With respect to the principal issue raised in Mr. Javel's appeal, the post-arrest statement of non-testifying co-defendant Aisha Arroyo does not present a Bruton problem because her statement was so thoroughly redacted and all references to Mr. Javel and his company Bell Capital were so thoroughly purged.
Why was there any need to purge the references to his company? And if I were a juror, I'd begin to get worried when people are playing coy and not saying what company it is. Right? Is it because you also thought that the jurors would impute Arroyo's knowledge to Javel?
I didn't want to take
and
the...
That's what the prosecutor was worried about. Maybe we did need more of an instruction.
As the government in this case, we wanted to make sure that there was no possibility that there could be any sort of imputation through the introduction of this statement.
That can't be right. The jury was bound to understand that Arroyo and Javel worked in the same workplace. Trying to conceal that from them by cute statements or evasions in a redacted confession doesn't really help. It draws attention to it. So why didn't you propose a concrete instruction saying Arroyo's knowledge can't be imputed to Javel? You members of the jury, you have to just ask what Javel knew, not what Arroyo knew.
Judge, I think that was an error on all of the parties' part, not proposing a concrete instruction that would have addressed
that. And that's the real problem here. It's not that the redacted statement is talking about Javel. The problem in this case is about the lack of an instruction.
Well, with respect to that particular instruction, a concrete instruction was not there. I think when you look at the totality of the instructions that the judge did give throughout the course of the trial, I think that under this court's precedent in the Ward decision, that the district court properly instructed the jury that they were to only consider the evidence, specifically Ms. Arroyo's statement, against her.
But I think, actually, I agree with Ms. Caseberg that the court's comment about the seasoned bank account actually makes things worse. Maybe I'm just really literal, but he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I instruct you to accept the last answer made by Agent Secor regarding the seasoned bank account only insofar as it bears in the issues in this case regarding Ms. Arroyo." And so everybody nods their head, yes. But when he singles out one statement for that, isn't the inference that everything else is open for whatever they want to use it for?
I don't think so, Judge.
Especially, I probably would have thought that, unfortunately.
Well, but I think when you consider, though, the statement that was actually introduced at trial, the only thing that came out regarding what Agent Secor was saying was about what Ms. Arroyo said and did. There was nothing about Bell Capital. There was nothing about Javel. There wasn't even any oblique references as we've sometimes referred to, generic references to other individuals or other companies. The only thing that was in that statement was what Ms. Arroyo said and did.
But the jury knows that she works for Bell Capital. The jury knows she works in his office. They're not fools. You know, they're going to add two and two together. And if she's doing all this stuff, I mean, you can't be saying that you didn't want them to think about the fact that these people happen to be in business together.
But I think the two and two, Judge, that you're referring to goes back to that the case that you referred to during the other part of the oral argument, the Richardson case. It's that two and two is not that's inferential incrimination, and inferential incrimination is not something that's part of the Bruton analysis. That's what the Supreme Court said in Richardson. It's what this court has said in multiple instances from Green from last year on down. So
what's the point of the instruction? I mean, you may be making a point that's too much, because you agreed, I thought, that Mr. Javel would have been entitled to an instruction that said, the one that Judge Easterbrook was saying, the specific instruction, you've heard about Ms. Arroyo, you can't make inferences about Mr. Javel from that.
I, I,
Because he didn't have confrontation right. You know, go back to the purpose of Bruton.
Absolutely. And I did agree with Judge Easterbrook at the beginning that a more robust instruction might have been helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, though, when you evaluate it, not only under the plain error standard that this Court is required to consider it, but when you take a look at the statement itself and how so thoroughly cleansed it was and so thoroughly purged it was, I don't really think that we've met that plain error standard given that particular fact, given the fact that the statement is so thoroughly redacted, that the bulk of the other instructions that were in fact given, plus the plain error standard, on top of the fact of the other evidence that was presented at trial.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Why don't you quickly review the other evidence against Mr. Javel having nothing to do with this?
And putting completely aside the statement, the other independent evidence that was introduced at trial that established Mr. Javel's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt was significant. He was on multiple recordings that took place at his office. He was, when there was a particular instance during the July 25th, 2008 meeting at his office where Ms. Arroyo said to to the cooperating individual and the undercover officer, guess what? I ran your paperwork through the Countrywide lender, and they have a problem with the particular bank account that's listed on your mortgage loan application. It hasn't been open for a sufficient period of time. So it was Mr. Javel and Ms. Arroyo who said, well, here's the solution to that particular problem. Go ahead and add the straw buyer's name to another account, put that account, new account, on the application, and then once the deal goes to closing, shortly thereafter, take the strong buyer's name off of that account, all in an effort to kind of pull the wool over the eyes of Countrywide Bank. We have that on tape. That's on recordings. There's also the documents that were included in the actual mortgage loan application itself that were fraudulent. Mr. Javel's representation that he had a face-to-face meeting with the straw buyer. The Kareem El Gamel letter, which was discussed in the brief, which is completely fabricated. We had testimony from agents who said that this letter never came from any representative of the government, and it was made out of whole cloth by the individuals at Bell Capital, faxed from Bell Capital to Countrywide Bank. That again was fraudulent on its face. After the deal was actually closed, there was another recorded meeting with the cooperating individual and Mr. Javel and Ms. Arroyo, where once again there was a discussion about how many payments the cooperating individual who was essentially in control of the deal was going to make on this particular loan before letting it fall into foreclosure. And Mr. Javel's specific warning to the cooperating source, Issa O'Day, you know what, the FBI has a brand new team out there that's looking for first payment defaults, so at least make a couple of payments before letting it go into foreclosure to avoid having the FBI give additional scrutiny to this particular loan. Mr. Javel, again, made specific suggestions about how long the straw buyer's name should remain on that additional count before it can be taken off. Again, as I indicated just before, in an effort to kind of pull the wool over the eyes of Countrywide Bank. And it was also at that meeting where the cooperator gave a $500 payment to Ms. Arroyo for her assistance in putting together the loan. So I think when you do consider all of that evidence, which is completely independent of anything that might have existed in Ms. Arroyo's statement, I think that plain error has not been met with respect to the jury instruction issue. And again, I think that the law is very clear that the redactions that contained in the statement were sufficient under Richardson, its progeny, as well as the decisions of this court in Green and other cases, essentially leaving to the point that the only person, when you look at the four corners of the statement, the only person who committed the offense and who admitted to anything in that statement was Ms. Arroyo herself. If there are no other questions, I would ask respectfully that the court affirm the conviction of Mr. Javel. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further?
Very briefly. Um, My opponent is a very good advocate, but I would like to point out factually that out of all of this so-called enormity of this independent evidence, there's actually two specific incidents that Mr. Javel is implicated in, and they are conversations. And I direct the court's attention to government's exhibits 5 and 22, which are the transcripts of those recordings. What you'll see when you read the transcripts is that while Mr. Javel did discuss getting the name put on a friend or family member's account, that he also said, I can put you in a higher interest rate bracket, but I don't want you to come back and say, why'd you give me 9% instead of 7%? This doesn't come across as the mind of someone who's engaged in a fraudulent scheme. The other conversation is after the alleged crime has already taken place. So the mortgage application has been submitted to Countrywide, been accepted, and then afterwards the FBI agents come back under the guise of another potential mortgage deal they want to engage in, and they're asking him the questions, and he's responding and talking about how the FBI is looking at first payment defaults. It also factually...
Thank you.
Is that it? Okay, thank you.
The case is